Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 216, The Light Inside Dark Times with Michael Mead.
Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast with your host, Dr. Dave. Coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area, Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
I operate out of the idea that this whole world is made of stories. It's not made of facts. As a matter of fact, most times when people say the fact of the matter is, they're about to tell you a story. They're a twisted version of the fact, usually. But the world is made of stories. And so young people who have a harder time growing up now, in other words, one of the jobs of young people used to be to rebel against the traditions of their own culture. But when the culture is in such rapid change, it's hard to rebel against it. So some of them just attack it, and others just disappear away from it. And so what's interesting, though, is if you start to tell them a story, they become very intrigued because it talks to the depth of their own soul.
That was the voice of my guest, mythologist and storyteller Michael Mead. Michael Mead has studied myth, anthropology, history of religion, and cross-cultural rituals for over 35 years. His hypnotic and fiery storytelling, street-savvy perceptiveness, and spellbinding interpretations of ancient myths and symbols are highly relevant to current culture. He has an unusual ability to distill and synthesize these disciplines, tapping into ancestral sources of wisdom while connecting them to the stories of people today. He's the author of The World Behind the World, also The Water of Life, Initiation and the Tempering of the Soul. He's editor with James Hillman and Robert Bly of Rag and Bone Shop of the Heart, and editor of Crossroads, A Quest for Contemporary Rites of Passage. Michael Mead is also founder of Mosaic Multicultural Foundation, a network of artists, teachers, and activists that fosters community healing and development efforts. Now, here's the interview. Michael Mead, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. Good to talk to you, David.
Well, I'm so pleased to have you here today for several reasons. One is that just this morning I put up an interview with Kwame Scruggs, who you have worked with and who's so quick to express his indebtedness to you.
Oh, yeah. Kwame's a great soul. He's a, you know, just a delightful person and doing great work with, you know, young people that need a lot of directions and guidance and support in where he lives in Ohio.
Yes, I had the same impression of him. How did you and Kwame come to work together?
Well, I think this is what happened. I was doing a presentation, you know, myth and culture or something like that. But it happened to be in an African-American church somewhere near Oberlin, Ohio. And so that confused people. People didn't know if it was for the African-American community or somebody else. And but anyway, Kwame showed up, and on a break, he came up and asked me to sign a book, which was, you know, I'd written this book called The Water of Life. And, you know, I liked him right away, and I was signing the book, and he said something like, I've bought 94 copies of this book and gave one to everyone I've worked with and every friend I have.
Wow, what a tribute.
And I thought, well, this is a guy that doesn't hold back.
Right.
And it turns out that that's exactly how he is. Once he makes a connection to you, he's going to give at least 94%.
Wow, that's wonderful. That's really wonderful. You know, another reason why I'm so happy to connect with you is of late, as I've been doing these interviews, I've sort of been wondering, you know, what can I offer my listeners to help them through these, quote, dark times? Because I know many have lost their jobs. People are out looking for work. The stock market plunged and so on. And so I've kind of had in the back of my mind, I've sort of posed that question to a couple of guests at the end of an interview, but I've had in the back of my mind that I really would like to speak with someone who could speak directly to that issue. So you can imagine my surprise and delight upon receiving your CD set that's titled The Light in Dark Times. And so I've really been enjoying that. It does speak exactly to this issue. Evidently, that's really kind of the tack that you've been on of late. And I'm still reading your book, The World Behind the World. And the theme of darkness of this current time seems to run through both of them.
Yeah, both of them are responses that I have to the troubled times that we live in and to the troubles that I think that are going to continue. And so it seems like you have two ways to go. You can say, oh, this is overwhelming, and oh my God, I wish I didn't have to go through this. Or you can turn it around and say, well, I'm already in this. Not only am I in it, everybody's in it by now. And maybe there's something to learn from going further through it. The word fear, which is now, you know, fear is being used to manipulate everybody and take everyone's courage and imagination away. And yet fear comes from the old Anglo word fair. It means to go through things. It doesn't mean to run away from things. And so there's something we have to go through here. And then I remembered the old idea that the soul, which is something I'm very interested in, you know, some people say we're here to make and to grow our souls. One title for the soul is the light inside the darkness. So if we penetrate and trust that life has meaning and value, we can find the soul, which is also called the hidden light.
Now, where does that come from, about the soul being the light in the darkness? Is that a root of the word, or just what's the origin?
No, it's part of old Western philosophy. You know, the roots of Western philosophy are not abstract knowledge. They are actually much closer to tribal cultures in that ancient philosophy has to do with intentionally removing oneself from the melee of daily life. And often they used to retreat into caves and go into what people now would call meditation, but it used to be called contemplation in the West. And in that darkness, allow the soul to release its hidden light. So it's really an old philosophical idea.
Mm-hmm. Now, in a way, the title, The Light in Dark Times, is a bit surprising, because I also think you warn against trying to go directly and prematurely to the light. Do I have that right?
Yeah, it gets complicated.
Okay.
The Western world, you take the Enlightenment. I always say to people, remember the Enlightenment? In case you didn't get the memo, it's over.
Yeah.
And now we're in the Endarkenment. And so this world we live in goes back and forth between light and dark. It does it every night and every morning again. That's the essential cosmological condition of living on Earth. But in order to be able to absorb genuine light, the light of intelligence, the light of love, all those kind of things that carry light, a person needs to be grounded. And part of grounding is a descent into darkness. In alchemy, it was called circulatio, the kind of rising into the light and followed by descending into the dark and then returning to the light that we were supposed to circulate. It's also called rising to spirit, descending to soul. And it's what modern culture refuses to do. It won't allow a little bit of descent, a little bit of loss of momentum, a little bit of loss of gross national product, whatever they want to call it. They're so afraid of losing that little bit that they hold on, manipulate, and cheat against life. And what happens then is a big descent like we're in now.
Yes. You know, I teach a university course on myth, dream, and symbol, and one of the books that we read in that course is Joseph Campbell's Hero with a Thousand Faces. And he also points out that the journey is a journey down. And in that regard, I liked your observations about spirit versus soul, which I haven't heard anywhere else. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, I'm drawing on an old thing, and thank you for mentioning Campbell's, you know, recognition of dissent. I think it's like page 121 in that book. I remember when I first read it in the mid-60s, it really struck me how smart that was. Then he became known for Follow Your Bliss.
Yes.
And I always said, I think he meant follow your blisters.
I like that.
In other words, where our wounds are, the old notion was that a wound is also a womb. That if a person will trust their own woundedness, they will find hidden in that wounded place the womb of the next stage of their life. So that's connected again to the distinctions between spirit and soul, which is, again, part of old cosmology and mythology. Spirit is always related to air and to fire, heat, and it rises. So spirit is the thing that wants to bring us up and lead us to peak experiences. Soul is connected to water and earth, and it has a natural pull downwards, and that's connected to the soul. And so for a person to become a full person, they have to, through a sequence of changes, rise to the height of their intelligence, the height of their imagination, the height of their spirit, but alternatively, and exchanging back and forth, descend to the depth of their woundedness, to the depth of their human deep connections, and descend and grow the body of the soul.
That really makes a lot of sense to me, and I love the integration that you've done there, between, you know, that circularity that you're talking about the balance of going up, going down, going up, going down. And in, I loved your story about the origin of the saying that there's a silver lining in every dark cloud. Would you share that with us?
Well, I live in a small community, and, go to the bank, and I've been going to the same bank for many years, and, you know, so I know the tellers and all, and there's a woman that works there, and she was telling me how people were losing their jobs, which is very noticeable in a small community. When it happens, it affects everybody because it's more interrelatedness. And then right at the point where I was going, it's really difficult, and we have to, you know, build more community in order to hold on to people, she didn't want to stay there, and she said, well, you know, it's dark and difficult, but there's always a silver lining. And I said, there is? I didn't know it, you know. And then I realized, I don't like that saying. So I researched it quickly. And it turns out that it comes from way back in old English literature. And the saying wasn't that there's always a silver lining. It was more like, am I deceived? Or does that dark cloud open itself and reveal a silver lining? And it was John Milton who wrote it, actually. And Milton is one of the darkest, heaviest persons you can read in Western literature. So it wasn't a promise of a silver lining. It was a question of whether it was there or not. So then I got curious, well, if he didn't say that, who did say that? And I tracked it down, and it turned out to be P.T. Barnum of the Barnum and Bailey Circus, who is also famous for saying, there's a sucker born every minute. So then I started to say to people, the two ways to be a sucker nowadays is to be naive. Every cloud is a silver lining. That's a naive attitude. But the other way to be a sucker is to be cynical, to protect oneself by wrapping oneself in denial or in darkness. And the trick of being alive right now is to tolerate the tension. Yes, there may be silver linings in the clouds. And then again, we might live a long time in darkness. And I think in that tension, that doesn't solve it through naivete or too quickly, and doesn't refuse to feel the presence of heavy things in dark times. In that tension, as Jung said, a person's soul can mature.
Yes. Now, you've got a relatively new book. Your latest book is The World Behind the World. What's behind that title? What is the world behind the world to which you refer?
Well, it's another old image. that this world, the world that everybody's so concerned with, involved with, and worried about, the world of daily reality, the world of the stock market, the world of measurable things, this world is only the front for the bigger world, which is the eternal world that's behind everything. So that what we call the world is actually used to be called the little world. And the real world, the word real world, the phrase real world, referred to everything behind this world. So this world, and I keep waiting to hear people that have authority realize that authority comes from an unseen place. All authority, the beginning of which word is author, the capacity to make and create, doesn't come from this world. All authority comes from the other world. And so what people are missing now is not simply changes or improvements in this world. What people are missing most often is a connection to the other world, the world behind the world. People don't need more time. I know everybody thinks we do. People need more eternity. That's what's missing. And eternity is found in the world behind the world.
Interesting.
So it's a mythological perspective.
Yes, yes. Now, you tell a story of an old woman weaver in the dark cave with her bubbling cauldron and the black dog, and it sets up the situation very nicely. Would you mind recounting that for us?
Yeah, I often call that story Why the World Can't End.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is, this is an old Native American tale, and it says that despite all the roads and all the trails and all the ways of moving around in the world and everybody looking for something, rarely does anybody find the cave where real knowledge exists. And of course, you can hear the resonance in old ancient Greece with Socrates and Plato and the cave of knowledge as well. So this
Sure.
is an old notion that you find throughout the world. Well, in this cave, when you go in, if you should find it, what you see is an old woman weaving a beautiful garment, and she's been weaving it for a long time. And then what happens is she has a second job. Maybe that's connected to a woman's work is never done. I don't know. But there's a second job because at the back of the cave, there's a huge cauldron with a fire under it. And what's stewing in the cauldron are all the seeds of all the plants and all the flowers and all the grains of the world. And she has to go back once in a while and stir that stew, kind of the stew of existence. As she's walking back, and she's old and she's tired from her weaving work, the black dog, which wasn't mentioned until that moment, goes over to the weaving, picks up a loose thread, pulls on the thread, and unravels the whole beautiful garment she's been weaving for such a long time. She stirs the cauldron, she comes back and stands there and looks at everything, all her work, all her creative energies, everything unraveled in a big chaotic mess on the ground. And after moments of deliberation, she sits down, picks up the chaotic threads, and begins to weave again. And a new imagination comes into her mind, and she begins to weave the garment all over again. And then, it's not said in the story, but it's known in the tribe, she's the old woman of the world, and what she's weaving is this world we live in, what I was just calling the world in front of the world. She's weaving this world that everybody's so worried about, but she, from the chaos of loss, she starts a new design. So the story's trying to say, yes, we're in the unraveling of this design. Things are falling apart. The black dog is tugging from all directions. And yet, from the point of view of mythology, from the point of view of deep intelligence, the world will remake itself from its own chaos, which is very close to chaos theory in Western science.
Interesting. It reminded me a bit of the myth of Sisyphus with having to kind of do the work all over again, but there was the added element that you put in of her reimagining, and so creating something that maybe has a bit of a new pattern to it rather than just the same old thing over and over again.
And there you can find a big difference between what happened to Greek mythology and tribal stories and tribal imagination, which I think stayed closer to nature, because that old woman who's weaving the world is also called Mother Earth, and she's also called Mother Nature. And nature, which many people now think is dissociated from culture or from human life, nature is the image, the daily design that shows us how the world comes in and out of creation and out of existence every day. Every night, the world, the daylight world ends. And instantaneously in the morning, it's woven again from the first rays of sunlight. That's the way people used to understand this world. So that darkness wasn't forbidding. Darkness was the source of creation, which, you know, technically is true. It's true for astrophysics, and it's true for cosmology. So tribal cultures, ancient philosophies, all had an affinity for the dark, because they knew that any light you could ever find, you would find the source of in darkness. So I'm trying to reach way behind modern concerns and what I see as the limitations of modern thought and modern science to touch the ancient imagination, which is the inheritance of everybody, which says that, yes, things fall apart, but even in our own lives, if we're honest, we can find the places where it fell apart, and then we can find nearby the thread that got picked up to weave it again. And I feel like I have to do this because I work frequently with young people who are in trouble. And what Western thought and Western cultural practice offers to young people when they get in trouble is just not helpful, and it's not enough for them to grab onto. And yet they take these old stories and they get it right away. Every young person I've ever worked with knows that black dog and how it ended their own life.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about the role of story, because I know you use it a lot in your work. What's the role that story plays in working with these young people?
Well, you know, I mean, I operate out of the idea that this whole world is made of stories. It's not made of facts. As a matter of fact, most times when people say the fact of the matter is, they're about to tell you a story. Their twisted version of the fact, usually. But the world is made of stories, and so young people who have a harder time growing up now, in other words, one of the jobs of young people used to be to rebel against the traditions of their own culture. But when the culture is in such rapid change, it's hard to rebel against it. So some of them just attack it, and others just disappear away from it. And so what's interesting, though, is if you start to tell them a story, they become very intrigued, because it talks to the depth of their own soul. And it's a way of communicating in the most human immediacy. And so I use it when I work in prisons. I use it when I work with gang kids. I use it with homeless people. I use it with everybody. To me, it's the natural language of people, story.
Yeah, some people have said that we've lost our story. What do you think about that idea?
We've lost those big containing stories. That's what I was referring to with the Enlightenment, you know, for, I don't know, a couple hundred years there. The Western cultures thought that if you could get the right light to shine on things, then you could find all the knowledge and all the facts, and that would be enough to fix everything. And so that's kind of a story that the culture has carried. It's the story of science to a large degree, and it's a story of Christianity to a large degree. And then it turns out not to be the whole story. And it's maybe not even half the story. You know, science has now figured out that the universe is 94% dark matter and dark energy, as if the Enlightenment has brought all the way back to the darkness. And so we're dealing more with the black holes now than we are with the bright lights. And so in that sense, we've lost our story, not just the biblical narrow vision of creation, but also the common story, philosophical story that we base ourselves in. So modern culture is somewhat storyless now. Mm-hmm. And I should mention, that's part of what's driving some of the outside edges of the political spectrum into a madness, into a frenzy. Because if you take the story of America, that it's number one, top of the world, all that kind of thing, and it starts to unravel.
Yes.
And not be true. You have a bunch of people out on the fringe that literally believe that story. And as they see before their own eyes it disappearing, they fall out of story and into madness.
And maybe that's true of fundamentalism as well, or fundamentalism in general, because that kind of super patriotism that you're talking about is, I would see that as a variety of fundamentalism.
Yes, it is a variety, because patriotism is a substitute for religion in the sense that it's full of fixed beliefs.
Yes.
And yeah, fundamentalism is a literalizing of the story.
Exactly.
Whether it's the political story or cultural story or the religious story.
Yes.
And literalism is the real culprit in modern life. And it's interesting when you look at it, and I did write about it in The World Behind the World, the two groups that are most literalistic are the religious groups, the fixed religions, or the, you know, the religions of the book, they call them, and those that believe in positivistic science. So science and religion, which are so divided typically in American life, come together on this kind of habit of literalism. Literalism kills stories. Stories are based on metaphor. Metaphor means to be carried beyond the obvious. And we need more metaphors, and I'm saying we need more imagination, and we need more eros, that is to say, instinctive, intuitive connections, and we need more, I don't know, what would you call it, love of life and trust that everything's not going to disappear. It's just radically reorganizing itself. So one more step. When everything seems to fall apart, there's two places to go. Back into big ideas, I call it old cosmology, which reminds us the stars are still following their courses. The trouble that most of what we're dealing with are both nature and culture unraveling at the surface of the earth. That's, so you go either to ancient cosmology, which offers some easing of that concern, or you go deep into oneself, because both Eastern and Western spiritual practices used to offer and still can that in the depth of oneself is one's only security, one's only real anchor in this world.
Yes.
And I have found exactly that working with people that are in extreme trouble.
Mm-hmm. Your discussion of literalism kind of sets up my next question, which was to ask you about the role of poetry in dark times.
Poetry, I often say, is the natural speech of the soul. The soul really doesn't speak like CNN. You know, the human soul is a wondrous beast, they used to call it, and not easily deterred once it's allowed to have some room. And so poetry is the soulful speech of human life. And in poetry is based on taking unlike things and putting them together. That's what all creative artists are doing. And so when we lose poetry, we lose the capacity to even describe our own experiences. And I don't mean it just in from the abstract point of view. What we have a program we call Voices of Youth. And we go into very difficult, rough neighborhoods and work with violent gang youth. And I tell them stories, and that intrigues them. But then I tell them that I want them to tell their own story. And in proximity with a mythic story, they will almost always reveal their own story. Once they start telling their story, then I say, now I want you to convert it to poetry. And there's a way in which every young person is poetic. I'm not saying they're all good poets, but everybody has poetry inside them. And so even these most violent, most rejected, most offended young people can convert their own story in a matter of a couple of days into poetry, and then they will tell it to whoever shows up for these, you know, presentations we make. And in the converting of their story to poetry and in expressing it out loud, they find a part of themselves that is poetic, that is soulful, that is imaginative, and that had been covered over with pain and anger and whatever all it was. And suddenly they have a glimpse of their inner poetic life. And I have seen that cause more immediate, valuable change in young people than anything else I've ever seen. And Kwame has seen the same thing, and everybody I know that works with young people, including most good teachers, realize that education of any kind is trying to awaken and bring to consciousness the poetic soul of the student.
Yes, I want to talk some more near the end about your outreach, your various outreach programs, of which that was one. You talk about old mind and youth, olders and elders, and the tasks of each. So let me have you take us through that, if you will.
Okay. Well, on the cultural, social level, cultures form, of course, around birth and how to take care of the mother and the child, because that's the future of the tribe or the community. And then the next big challenge, really, is when the children try to become adults, when they become youth, which is like a transitional in betwixt and between stage in which they're supposed to leave childhood behind in order to self-reveal their own life and become themselves. So cultures are formed to a large degree to handle that transition. And in making that transition, what's needed are mentors, people who have already been through it, and elders, people who have survived their own lives and drawn wisdom from living experience. So to me, that's a quick description of the chain of knowledge and the chain of being, going from, particularly from youth, mentor, elder. Modern culture has none of these, very little of these rites of passage, initiatory process that can help a person become themselves rather than just a version of everybody else. And therefore, what happens in modern culture is people grow older but don't grow elder. People just simply grow older without becoming wiser. And you're seeing it now with the healthcare debate and everything. The elders are not afraid of either life or death. And when life gets difficult and when death gets imminent, it's the elders everybody turns to. They don't freak out. They don't attack. You can't shock them. You can't surprise them because they've lived into the depths of their own lives. So in a way, what's happened now is we don't have enough elders, which means we don't have enough mentors, because mentors like a step to become an elder. And that means then that the youth are abandoned to video games and Xboxes and all that kind of substitute stuff. And the olders, instead of being elders and holding on to the wisdom of life and survival, how to survive with meaningful things, the elders start to act like infantile or like infants, screaming for something they think they want, instead of helping the culture hold together life and death. So, psychologically speaking, or philosophically speaking, the youth and the elders are mirrored inside people as the eternal youth within and the old sage within. And so, since we can't change the course of history, as our friend Obama is finding out how difficult that is to do, what's more quick on an individual basis and sometimes more accurate is to bring a person into contact with their own eternal youth inside and their own old wise person inside. Elders remain young because they have access and connection to the eternal youth inside the elder. And young people can become wise. Everybody's met young people that you go, wow, that's an old soul. And that means the young person has found the old sage in themselves. And so working nowadays, like I do, with young people in trouble and sometimes with old people in trouble, that's the place I go, to the psychological, philosophical, internal connection between the eternal youth and the old wise person within, in hopes that eventually some of that stuff will come back into the culture at large.
Yes. Now, not to embarrass you too much, but you strike me as an elder and as a good role model, in fact, for being an elder. How did you get to be that way?
Well, let me just preface by saying elder is not a fixed position. That's one of the problems. You can't elect an elder, and you can't, it's really more of a state of imagination or a state of mind. By the way, youth is not a fixed position either. A lot of young people now are way older than their age. So elder to me, it is a state of imagination or a presence of a certain kind of wisdom that erupts into a person, that comes upon a person. And so, you know, maybe at times I'm able to stand in that kind of threat of intelligence. And if I am, it's from a couple of things. One is taking risks. I risk life to find more life. So I, by choice, go into prisons, work with people that are really trapped, literally, in darkness. I work with young people, both, you know, they come in two types, the homies and the homeless. I work with both of them. I work with the refugees who have lost everything. And in doing that, it's strange. You find that those who have lost everything are closer to the verge of finding everything. And so I've learned something from that, I think. And it makes me less afraid of dark things and less afraid of dangerous things. Not that I don't have fear, but a little bit less. And then the other thing I would say is stories, mythology, is the greatest teacher I've ever found. I live by, learn from, and nourish myself on stories. And when I find myself completely overwhelmed or something, which happens by virtue of taking risks, I step back into the story that comes to mind, and I let the story teach me how to act and how to live.
Well, I'm really interested in some of the biographical details of your life. you know, I'm trained as a psychotherapist, of course.
Okay.
My instinct is to dig down and wonder about where you grew up and how you got into story and some of that stuff.
Well, the first time I remember telling a story, I mean, other than, you know, the things that you do as a kid, I was 13 years old. At the time, I was in a little street gang. I'd grown up in New York City, and I got cornered in the bathroom of a movie theater by seven members of a rival older gang who a friend of mine had offended. And they had, we called them the monkey wrench gang, because they used to take monkey wrenches and sharpen the back side of it so that they had not only a heavy weapon, but a blade.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And they were about to at least, you know, mangle me a bit. And I'm on the floor, and they're standing over me. And I learned a couple of things rather quickly. First of all, talk to the person who's in charge. So I figured out who the leader was, because that, you know, you only have human-to-human contact to work with. And I looked right in his eyes and spoke directly to him, and I just started telling a story. And slowly the weapons went down, and I could actually see the shift in the eyes. That when someone's going to do damage, they get a kind of a stare that is not, that goes right past everything. And I saw the kind of focus of the eyes come back. And to my surprise, and probably to their surprise, they let me go.
What was the story?
Well, as a psychologist, you'll probably get this rather quickly. I said, you know, I didn't do it. It's my friend. I know who you're talking about, and I know why he did it. And why is such a compelling question, even for armed people. And I quickly started to explain why. And the reasoning was that every day his older brother beats him. And then at night when his father comes home, his father beats him. So he's been beaten into a kind of insanity, which is the only thing that caused him to challenge this gang that could obviously wipe us out very quickly. Now, while I'm telling them this, which is true, mostly true, I'm also describing their own story. That's the neighborhood story that everybody gets the crap kicked out of them all the time, and that's why they go around kicking the crap out of people.
Yes.
So it was like a made-up, true, psychological, partially mythological story.
Uh-huh.
And essentially what happened is they saw their own experience in the story, and it was so compelling or accurate or whatever that they lost the edge of their intention and the edge of the weapons and the whole thing. So I go back to the corner. You know, I have to get out of there really as quickly as I can. I go back to the corner, And everybody can tell something has happened, and, you know, wow, what was it? And I said, well, you won't believe it. I found the most amazing thing. And I tell them the story of what just happened. And they all say, let's get the older guys. We're going to go get them. And I'm going, no, you missed the point. I found something much more powerful than fighting, much more powerful than weapons. I found a way to take away or at least alter that anger and that destructive intention. And, of course, no one got it. And so that was the beginning of me going, wow, that's a powerful thing, whatever it is.
Well, where did you go from there?
Well, the next significant thing, in a way, was my own descent and period of darkness, which included several months in solitary confinement.
Oh, wow.
And that was in a military prison in Panama, after I had realized, having been drafted, that I really couldn't just go kill people for reasons I didn't understand, or die myself for reasons that weren't clear and didn't have meaning that connected to my own soul. So I had gone, you know, I was in the Army, and I went and I said, you know, this is my fault.
Was this the Vietnam era?
Yeah, this is Vietnam.
Yeah, yeah.
And I shouldn't have come because I really can't do the thing you're asking me to do, you know. And so that led to court-martials and all kinds of stuff. And then it turned out I wasn't a good prisoner, you know. I got put in the prison, and I wasn't good at that. So
good for you.
I wound up in solitary confinement for quite a while. And in the midst of that, for some reason that took me a while to understand later on, I began a hunger strike. And after that went on for a while, that's when I had this, I don't know, I don't want to, a revelatory experience, which gives me the notion of why there's light inside dark. I'm in a cell, solitary. Oh, I don't know what it is. It's 10 by 12 feet, something like that. There's nothing in there but me, and I'm not even eating. So, and all of a sudden, I'm having visitors of all kinds. And, well, not of all kinds. I'm having visitors like Ulysses from the Odyssey. All these characters from stories that I had been intrigued with started showing up in the cell. So it occurred to me I was either losing my mind or I was finding my mind. And I think the latter is mostly what happened. Mm-hmm. I found out that my own life orientation has to do with mythic stories and what happens in those stories. And in the absolute dead emptiness of solitary confinement, the ones who did not abandon me were the characters and stories. And that was opened the whole world to me in a different way.
Wow, what a great story. I'm really glad we went down this particular path. By any chance, when you were on your way to military court-martial or prison, I'm wondering if you went through Philadelphia, because when I was an undergraduate at the University of Pennsylvania, I met a young guy who was just traveling through town. He didn't have a place to stay, and I found him a place in the dorm. And he was on his way. He had decided to become a conscientious objector after already being in the military, and he was marching kind of to his, quotes, doom. Was that by any chance you?
It wasn't me, but I sure feel for the fellow. No, it wasn't.
Okay.
One other little twist on that, which is I've never known what to do with. We don't know what sustains us in the world. I mean, I was just saying kind of what sustains me is characters from stories, mythic images, mythic presences, I guess you could say. But that's not quite enough. The connection between the other world, the mythical world behind the world, and this world has to be strengthened and maintained. So what actually happened on the practical level was someone had, I couldn't communicate with anybody. They wouldn't allow me to write or any of that. But one of the guards, I have to imagine, got in touch with Bobby Kennedy, who was the New York senator at the time. And when he found out the story, he called down to that, I don't know if it was the actual prison, probably not, but the command office down there, and said, you have one of my constituents in a cell there, and if he's not out in 48 hours, I'll come down to find out why.
Hmm.
And so out of the blue, they come in and offer me the papers to sign to go home. I've never met him afterwards. I never got to thank him. I don't know what he was thinking when he did that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
There things happen in the world that you cannot explain, that you can't, you know, that, but that can happen if a person trusts something in their own life. And that's what I use when I'm working with people in prison. I have to work with people in prison because of my own experience. And I have to work with young people because of my own experience.
Mm-hmm.
But in the back of my mind, I know that you make your best attempt, and you never know what can be brought into the world, what thread can be picked up by the old woman of the world and woven into the next step of your own life.
That's great. How did drumming come into your life and your work?
Well, in a funny way, I find all my gifts through struggle and through darkness, and late after that part of my life, things moved on, and my first daughter was born, my daughter, and she was very sick, and we wound up going like 7 doctors, and no one could figure out what was wrong, and it was tearing me apart, and I was out walking the street one night, really just trying to breathe my way through this anguish of being a father, a parent who could not help his own daughter find, you know, really life, it looked like. We thought we were going to lose her. And I heard this amazing music coming from inside one of these painted out storefronts. And I went over and the door was slightly open. I looked in and here was this African guy dancing and teaching people how to play marimbas and how to dance and how to drum and sing. And it was the most joyful, compelling thing that I just could not move. I slipped inside the door just to absorb it. It was like the antidote to my heavy, broken heart. And he said, "I see you there. You can't watch the way we do it. You have to dance or play or sing. So what is it going to be?" And I said, "No, I just want to watch and listen." He goes, "No, if you can walk, you can dance. If you can talk, you can sing. And if you can move, you can play." So there was a drum nearby, and I said, "Well, I'll play that." And he showed me a rhythm. I started playing. I stayed hours and hours, and he became a teacher for me, Dumasami Mariere. And suddenly, I had my hands on a drum, and that was turned out to be another good companion for me.
Wow.
I was very fortunate. I went from there. I met other African musicians who always turned out to be teachers as well, and I got invited into the whole kind of realm of African drumming, which led to a study of ritual and ceremony and how it's used to heal. And all of a sudden, I was introduced to a whole other world.
It is amazing how the universe kind of supports your journey when you find your true path.
Yeah, and especially the dark parts of that path. Because what I did was went home, I used to hold my daughter at night. She was in pain and she couldn't keep food down. And I would just put on music, and increasingly it was African music and music with a lot of rhythm, and I would just bounce her on my shoulder for hours and hours just to soothe her. And so the music was soothing me, but it was also soothing her. She has 3 children now, and she continues. She just loves music, and whenever something goes wrong, she puts music on right away. And, you know, so there's, through her woundedness, I got music.
Wow. These are such wonderful stories, and we could go on and on. I want to make sure that you have a chance to announce any upcoming workshops that you might have. I'll be sure to put a link in the show notes to your website, so certainly people will be able to get information that way. But do you want to announce any of your upcoming workshops?
Well, the first thing I think of is it's about a month away. In San Francisco. So I continue with the music and the poetry and the stories. And so that side of things, I'm doing an event with a group of Middle Eastern musicians called Kadim. And it's a play on the light inside dark times. We call it, This Darkness is Your Candle. And I talk, a bit about light and dark. I tell short stories from mythological perspective, and then I start to recite poems from Rumi and Hafez and the mystical tradition while this tremendous orchestra plays music from Iraq, Iran, Turkey, and other places. It's just a delightful thing. And it's part of my sense that what the mystics do with darkness is turn it into music and ecstatic imagination. So that's one event. That's in San Francisco. I think it's September 17th is what comes to mind. And then the next 2 days, the 18th and 19th, are in L.A., Santa Monica, I think. It's on the website.
Okay.
And that's the Light Inside Dark Times and a workshop called The Soul of Change, which is about how do you survive all these changes and how do you use it to make your own soul healthier, deeper, and wiser. So that's in L.A., the 18th and 19th of September. And those, I guess there's links on your website. And then our website is www.mosaicvoices.org.
Great. Well, is there anything else you'd like to say before we close?
Well, here's what just came to mind as you asked. Ikkyu is a Japanese Buddhist Zen monk and poet, he was. And he has a long poem about how a person, something inside people wants to live a long life. But he ends it by saying, in the meantime, despite what everybody tells you, you have to accept where you are. And he says this beautiful thing to me. To me, it's beautiful. You can't help but be who you are and where. And once a person accepts that, whether it's a prison cell or unemployment line, you can't help but be who you are and where. A full acceptance of that is the beginning of the opening of the next stage of life.
Well, that's a perfect wrap. And Michael Mead, thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're very welcome, David. Thank you for your work.
I trust that you are as moved and inspired by Michael Mead as I was. What a story, and what a storyteller. As you heard me say in my intro, I've really wanted to bring you some positive messages about coping in these dark times. I've heard from some of you that you've lost your jobs or having trouble finding work or that the events in the world have been getting you down. I think Michael speaks to these times in a way that broadens our perspective and also taps into and stimulates our own deep wisdom. I also think the work that Michael is doing with young people and with prisoners is so important. I had hoped to explore that with him in more depth, but we ran out of time. However, you can find more detail on his website and by getting on his mailing list. I also strongly endorse his CDs and books, which you'll find on his website as well. I'm hoping to be at his September 17, 2009 presentation in San Francisco. I might very well be wearing a shirt that says Shrink Wrap Radio on it. So if you see me there, be sure to come up and say hi. Michael's website, once again, is www.mosaicvoices.org, and I'll spell that out for you. It's MOSAICVOICES.
Let us all come together to see what we can find. Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you it's all in your mind. Let us all remember what you seek is what you find. Dr. Davis here to remind you it's all in your mind.
Well, you may be surprised, and I hope delighted, to have this podcast show up just 1 week after the last one with Kwame Scruggs. I accelerated this one both because it's such a perfect follow-on to that interview with Kwame, and also because I wanted to get the word out about Michael Mead's San Francisco presentation in plenty of time for Bay Area residents to be able to take advantage of the announcement. Don't be surprised if some of the upcoming episodes show up in weekly rather than bi-weekly intervals. I have several upcoming shows that also have time-sensitive information, which will drive a quick release on my part. Hey, do I have any listeners in Kauai? I'm going to be vacationing there September 4th through September 10th with my good friend, Dr. Ronald Alexander, who you heard on Shrink Wrap Radio number 29, Mindful Leadership, Mindful Living. He's just written his first book. It's a real crackerjack. And I'll be interviewing him again about that real soon. At any rate, if you're on Kauai, I'd love to meet you. Drop me an email or leave me voicemail and we'll set something up. We have a new sponsor of sorts. If you go to www.behavioralhealthcentral.com and click on the radio tab, you'll find 10 past episodes of Shrink Wrap Radio there. Or you can go directly to those episodes by going to www.shrinkwrapinterviews.com. Since these are old episodes, you may have already heard them. BehavioralHealthCentral.com is a new web portal that has lots of information and links to behavioral health resources. You might want to check it out. And here's hoping that they decide to pick up more Shrink Wrap Radio episodes on an ongoing basis. I like the ring of behavioral health. It sounds very mainstream, and it's good to be associated with such a legit operation. My interview with Peter Bregan, MD, on the psychopharmaceutical complex is still the current one on Wise Counsel podcast, last time I looked. Check it out if you haven't already. Peter Bregan has accurately been called the Ralph Nader of psychiatry. Please remember to tell your friends, colleagues, family, and so on about Shrink Wrap Radio. And I really appreciate it when you mention it on your blog, your Facebook, or your Twitter. I seem to be gathering more friends on Twitter, and you can follow my tweets at twitter.com/shrinkwrapradio. By the way, if you're not subscribed to Shrink Wrap Radio, it costs you nothing to do so, and it just means that the episodes get automatically delivered to you, and it does help me to track our audience size. The easiest way to subscribe is through iTunes, where there's a subscription link, and also on our page on Shrink Wrap Radio, you'll see a link to iTunes in the right-hand gutter. And speaking of iTunes, if you love this show and you haven't posted a review on iTunes, please do so. It's one of the things that helps keep us on the front page of their higher education shows. Have I mentioned lately that most of our shows have typed transcripts that you can download for free? Thanks to the volunteers who've made that happen. It provides incredible value, I think, so please help to support this show by making a donation. You have 5 years' worth of content here, complete with over 100 transcripts. And I know many of you are listening on an MP3 player in your car, or perhaps jogging or walking. Maybe you're waiting in the doctor's office or you're at the gym. You've got lots of good intentions to subscribe, you've meant to donate, you've meant to do it for some time. So don't lose that thought. Cross your fingers now or your toes and go to Shrink Wrap Radio and click on the big green donate button. And thank you also for your patronage of our sponsors where you get discounts. And you'll find the discount links on our site for GoDaddy, PetMeds.com, Brookstone, Budget Car Rentals, Angie's List, and Avis Car Rentals. Boy, with a list like that, you'd think we'd just be making money hand over fist. Is that how the hand over hand, hand over something? No, it's merely a trickle. But every little bit helps. So be sure to remember to use those discount codes. Thanks.
Hi, this is Kirk Honda.
And Lee Tavalis of the Psychology in Seattle podcast.
And you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thanks, Kirk and Lisa from Psychology in Seattle. Now let's catch up on some listener email. The first one reads, "Hi, Dr. Dave. Just to let you know, I've been spreading the word. I'm currently attending a course at the Gestalt Center in London for executive coaches using Gestalt techniques, and I've sent my fellow students your details. Many have responded with positive comments. The course is mainly attended by experienced executive coaches wanting to expand their coaching skills. Keep up the good work. It's really quality work. Your interviewing skills alone are a masterclass worth subscribing to. And that's signed by Alan. Alan, thanks so much. That's high praise indeed. I like that image, a masterclass. If only I could persuade my actual students at Sonoma State University of that fact. This next one is also from the UK and reads, "Hello, Dave. I was doing a little research on fetishism and discovered what I thought to be a little dysfunctional to be nothing but a partialism, i.e., that finding a woman's foot intriguing from a distance and not a fetish as such because it's attached to the body. I did a search for fetish on your site, but nothing came up. Partialism, too, nothing. Dreams must help with understanding, too. Some of my friends prefer the old-fashioned bust, butt, hair, etc., but in any case, I'd find it wonderful if you knew anyone who might be interested in coming on your show to talk about such a topic. Why do we humans have such weird fascinations with certain body parts? Is there one truth or 7 billion truths? Yours partially," and that's from Nicholas in Brixton, London, England. And Nicholas, you're right, I have not covered sexual topics very much on the show, I guess partly because I'm very cautious to try to keep it clean, which is not to say that sex is dirty. And so I'll keep that in mind. I would refer you to Psychology in Seattle, the one that we just ran the little ad for. They did a show called, they interviewed some people that are in Seattle who are doing something they call sex positive. I think you might find that fascinating. And that interview is available on Psychology in Seattle. There's both an audio version and a video version, so whichever one you like best. Moving right along, we hear from Laura in Akron, Ohio, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. This is Laura from Akron, Ohio again. I just finished listening to your interview with Dana Houck entitled Life Lessons from Hardcore Cons. You mentioned that you'd like to see Mr. Houck's method of using Jungian concepts and group work package to be used in other locations, preferably before individuals end up in correctional facilities. I just wanted to let you know that here in Akron, there is actually a school-based program called Alchemy, Inc., at alchemyinc.net, that uses mythological storytelling, African drumming, and the principles of depth psychology in a group format to address the issues of urban adolescent males. The founder, Kwame Scruggs, is a former student of Pacifica Graduate Institute and has a very interesting background combining the use of myths with rituals of the Akan life cycle system, West African rites of passage, to help young boys with a sense of guidance and purpose before they end up in prison or worse. Keep up the good work and fascinating interviews. I'm always glad to learn of the innovative work being done in this wonderful field of psychology. Have a great week. Laura, doctoral student in the collaborative program in counseling psychology at the University of Akron. Well, you can see how far behind I am in reading my email, because, of course, by now I had acted on Laura's suggestion, contacted Kwame Scruggs, and he was the previous episode, and that led to my discovery of Michael Mead in this current episode. So, Laura, you set this whole chain in action, and I really want to thank you for that. Now, the next one comes from Kathy at the Naval Undersea Warfare Center. Wow, what a diverse listenership I do have. Amazing. And Kathy writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave, just to let you know, I tried to donate using my credit card, but your donation page still thinks I'm trying to use a PayPal account. I tried 3 times, but no go." And she signs Kathy. And then P.S., "You're doing great work. I especially like number 207, Life-Changing Lessons from Hardcore Cons with Dana Houck. Of course, there are many more, but that's the one I listened to today during the morning commute." And that's from Kathy, Undersea Warfare Analysis Department. Kathy, I'm sorry that you went through that difficulty with the credit card. I think you have to have a PayPal account even to use a credit card. I'm not totally sure on that score, but I think that's how it works. Now, I've never had any problems with PayPal, Yeah, I've been using it for years and years, not only to receive money, but also to send money. And so I hope you won't give up and that nobody else will give up on that approach. It's the only economical means that I've been able to find for me to receive donations. Anything else, like linking up directly with credit card companies or other services specializing in credit cards, they have some pretty substantial fees that would just make it unreasonable. The next one reads, "Hi, Dr. Dave, I thought I would drop you a quick email to let you know that I finally set up a 12-month donation to you, something I've been meaning to do for quite a while. I was finally forced to move you to the top of my priority list after the triple whammy of one of your guests talking about the enjoyment of receiving recognition and you agreeing, a listener in a similar position to me finally doing it, and your last donation drive. I've been a fan of your show for over 2 years and have listened to all of the episodes that you've done, although I have to admit that I'm a few behind at the moment, about 10. I've found some of the guests a bit kooky, some wise, and some challenging, but I think from almost every interview, I've taken something away from it for a variety of reasons. Your podcast has been extremely useful to me over the last few years, so the donation is a part thank you for that. Keep up the good work. Many thanks, Chris." Chris, I really appreciate that donation, as well as donations from other listeners. You know, something I haven't shared here before is I actually have 3 kids who are still in college. So I'm still supporting 3 kids through college. So you can see why donations might come in handy. Okay, one more. "Hello, Dr. Dave. This is Patrick from the Netherlands. I once heard a comment on a non-psychology-related podcast that psychologically disturbed people tend to talk in an insisting way, like proclaiming their opinion like it's a fact. I think it might have to do that those kinds of people are not able or do not want to understand feelings and opinions of other people and are not willing to look at things from a different perspective. As a Chinese proverb says, if you don't understand your enemy, you're his slave, in which I actually agree." And then that's signed, "Sincerely, Patrick." And I seem to recall that Patrick is a very young man in the Netherlands. And Patrick, I think your observations sound about as good as any that I might make. So I think that'll wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio. Remember that in addition to emails, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemails on Skype, where our name is ShrinkPod. And in the past, I've announced MyChingo, but that service seems to be down now. It's not working. But you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks so much to my guest, Michael Mead, for sharing with us about the light inside dark times. You know, at this point, I'm not sure who my next interview will be, so you can look forward to being surprised. Please stay tuned for some brief sponsor announcements whose discounts could save you some money. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind. I want to thank our sponsor, Budget Car Rentals, for their support of Shrink Wrap Radio. May I suggest that you consider Budget.com for any of your automobile rental needs? Using my special code of SHRINK will get you or your family or friends that you share this information with $30 off weekly rentals or 10% off for other time periods. With Budget, you can rent like a genius. Next time you need someone to work on your home, repair your car, or fix your teeth, check Angie's List first. At Angie's List, you'll find thousands of unbiased ratings on hundreds of services. Just go to angieslist.com and use promo code SHRINK for 25% off your membership, or you can go to the Angie's List link on our site under the Promos tab for more information. Save money on your next car rental by going to avis.com/shrink. Avis tries harder with knowledge, caring, and a passion for excellence. You'll get 10% off or $30 off a weekly rental by going to avis.com/shrink or using the Avis link on our site at shrinkwrapradio.com.